How are you feeling? She asked quietly. To her credit and to her political disadvantage, Wasserman Schultz wears her heart on her sleeve. Not well, she huffed. We're obviously figuring it out, Renteria tried to reassure her. I know, Wasserman Schultz shot back. Hillary's aides concluded that it had not yet hit Wasserman Schultz just how bad the DNC leak story was and how much worse it was going to get. Her whole style and way was going to be on display very, very soon, said one of Hillary's lieutenants. We felt that we very much knew what was coming, that this wasn't getting better. She was definitely stuck in her world. Here's this key moment, and she was really self-absorbed. Wasserman Schultz caused such a stir that campaign aides didn't even want her backstage when Hillary arrived. They worried that Wasserman Schultz would get in Hillary's face and finagle a spot on the stage, so they banished the party chairwoman to the audience for the big speeches. If Wasserman Schultz didn't understand then that she was finished as a face of the Clinton campaign, and she didn't, she certainly should have. For years, a loose confederation of White House aides and senior lawmakers, including New York Senator Chuck Schumer and Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill, had been trying to push Wasserman Schultz out of the DNC post. Some Democrats believed she'd been an ineffective manager at the committee and that she put her personal priorities ahead of the party's when they came into conflict. But DWS had a tight relationship with Vice President Joe Biden, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid liked her spunk, and Obama didn't want to go through the pain of replacing her. He believed the party's nominee should determine the fate of the sitting DNC chair, a position that conveniently absolved him of responsibility for making a decision. The problem was that Hillary didn't want to make that call either. Now, though, the bill of particulars against Wasserman Schultz had just grown longer and more damning. And, in throwing what Clinton aides described as a tantrum over the campaign's effort to sideline her for the VP announcement, she was doing nothing to instill confidence in the small set of people who stood between her and an unceremonious sacking. By moving her out to the crowd, Hillary's team cleared the way for the candidate and her running mate to enter a party rather than a political funeral. The backstage area was set up with separate holding rooms for Hillary and for Kane, but everyone just hung out in Hillary's space as they waited to take the stage together for the first time as the Democratic ticket. John Podesta quietly brought Hillary up to speed on the Wasserman Schultz situation, but for the most part, the mood was jubilant. Greg Hale, Hillary's staging guru, walked the candidates through the blocking of going on stage and where they were to stand. They were awkwardly excited, like teens on a first date, and they were eager to pull out of the driveway. Are you ready? Hillary asked the preternaturally smiling Kane. He was. And with that, they walked out on stage together for the first time as running mates. Kane, who worked in Honduras as a young man, charmed Spanish speakers at a school where 61% of the student body is Hispanic by mixing fluent Spanish into his speech. His decision to do so created a not-so-subtle contrast with the anti-immigrant rhetoric of Donald Trump. If Hillary could pull off a win in Florida, where a quarter of the population is Hispanic, she would be all but certain to capture the presidency. She would need both a big margin of victory and heavy turnout among Florida Hispanic voters, a group distinguishable from Latinos in other parts of the country because of its large Cuban and Puerto Rican populations, to offset an influx of white voters who were listening to Trump's pitch. Though the VP rollout would generally garner good headlines, the choice of Kane infuriated Bernie supporters, who had hoped Sanders's campaign would force Hillary into picking a more liberal running mate. Kane, an early endorser of then-Senator Barack Obama in 2007, and later a chairman of the DNC and governor and senator from Virginia, reflected Hillary's comfort with the business community and free trade. He had campaigned in Virginia as an opponent of abortion, but had since made clear that he would support abortion rights in office. The movement of Hillary toward Kaine and the inability of Bernie's supporters to get everything they wanted in the party's platform did nothing to take the focus off Wasserman Schultz, who suddenly became the most visible and vulnerable target for their outrage. In her remarks that day, Hillary thanked Wasserman Schultz, a throwaway line that surprised and disappointed many Democrats, including some on the campaign. It was a flash of loyalty that came at the risk of refocusing attention away from the event and toward the implosion of the DNC and its chairwoman. As the rally was coming to a close, Podesta asked to see Wasserman Schultz in a private room, and Hillary's aides retrieved her from the crowd. Wasserman Schultz was fit to be tied. Her time out in the audience had done nothing to temper her anger, and Podesta wasn't having it. He soon emerged from the room and waited at the door for her, perhaps making sure that she left the scene without trying to get to Hillary. After a few seconds, Wasserman Schultz came out, composed and solemn-faced, and walked away. Podesta turned to one of his colleagues and summed up his conversation with the ambitious congresswoman this way: "If she's ever Speaker of the House, I'm done with politics." Chapter 15. But it looked great. As the delegates and officials of the Democratic Party from all over the country descended on Philadelphia the weekend before their national convention, Hillary faced a daunting task in unifying the disparate factions into one force that could defeat Donald Trump and the Republicans. She still had problems with millennials, progressives, and working-class whites. And she knew that the African-American base that had carried her through the primaries was unlikely to show up on Election Day in the numbers that had boosted Barack Obama twice. Trump, on the other hand, was profiting from a post-convention bounce that had brought him within the margin of error in national polling. His party was coming together, just as the wounds of her primary were being reopened by the devastating DNC email hacks. Before Democrats could turn their attention to unifying in the convention hall, they would have to take down a lightning rod for much of the negative energy. Holed up in a suite at the Marriott in downtown Philadelphia on Sunday, July 24th, the eve of the Democratic convention, Debbie Wasserman Schultz started to negotiate the terms of her surrender. The DNC chairwoman had long since become a walking symbol of the deep divisions between the Clinton and Sanders wings of her party. But now, with the release of stolen emails showing anti-Bernie sentiment at her DNC, she was becoming a serious threat to destroy Bernie's and Hillary's joint efforts to project and cultivate party unity heading into the November election. That's the essential function of a party convention: to show that the wounds of the primary season have healed and that the leaders of major factions fully support the nominee, whether those things are true or not. Of all the obstacles to Bernie's most ardent backers coming around, the selection of centrist Tim Kaine rather than Bernie or Elizabeth Warren for the VP slot among them, the most visible and aggravating was the prospect of Wasserman Schultz presiding over Hillary's nomination. Earlier that morning, Sanders had publicly called for her to resign. A Clinton campaign that didn't want her in the job in the first place was besieged with calls from panicked Democrats who worried that the whole convention could go down in flames if Wasserman Schultz wasn't removed from her post immediately. But DWS held an important card. If she didn't resign, it would take a vote of the DNC to oust her. That would create a destructive and indelible scene of division at the convention. It's not clear that she ever raised that issue, but the Clinton campaign was painfully aware of the party rules and the need to get Wasserman Schultz to walk away without a fight. The comfortable hotel suite had room for a small coffee table between chairs and a couch, but Wasserman Schultz sat at the dining room table as Charlie Baker, the chief administrative officer of the Clinton campaign, gently laid out the bleak scenario facing her. If Wasserman Schultz stayed in her job, Bernie's supporters would stage protests and try to shout her down from the convention floor. They were angry that Hillary had won, and now they believed they had evidence that DWS and her staff had rigged the primaries. Hillary's crowning moment was in danger of becoming a fiasco. Baker didn't have to say that it would be selfish, that Wasserman Schultz would be putting her own interests above Hillary's, those of the party, and those of the country, if she didn't just step aside. Try as she did to hold back her anger and frustration, DWS made them evident as she issued demands in return. She wanted an endorsement from Hillary and one from Obama, along with a guarantee that the party would be there for her on primary day in her home district. Furthermore, she didn't want to leave town, as some Democrats urged, and if she did, she wanted the party to pay for her to fly. It wasn't an unreasonable request. She had a number of family members in town for what she had expected would be a big moment for her, and it would be expensive for her to foot the bill to bring them all back to Florida early. Unfailingly transactional, Wasserman Schultz was worried that if she didn't have a deal in place, Obama and Clinton might withhold their support for her re-election, or say something so tepid as to be counterproductive. One DNC source who was not in the room said that DWS spent much of the day trying to negotiate the language Obama and Clinton would use in praising her if she resigned. By early afternoon, though, it was becoming clear to Wasserman Schultz that she had no way out. Obama spoke to her by phone, according to a White House official. He thanked her for serving as DNC chair, but declined to urge her to go or to stay. That was telling enough. Obama had never been a big fan of the DNC, and he had let the organization atrophy under DWS with all the concern of someone who didn't like the muck of party politics. There was no real choice for Wasserman Schultz, but she was the last to realize it. Her best friends were telling her she had to leave, said one source involved in the discussions. It was the only way. Finally, assured that Obama and Hillary would support her re-election, she acceded to the pressure. Baker, still operating out of Wasserman Schultz's hotel room, called Donna Brazile, the party vice chairwoman who had long before been designated to take over in the event of a vacancy. Brazile wasn't thrilled. To take the job, she'd have to detach from her lucrative business as a consultant. But she told Baker she knew that she couldn't turn it down. Brazile would present another set of challenges for Mook, because she was, as one ally put it, the polar opposite as a political operative. Someone who trusted her gut and intuition. But as a longtime operative in the matrix of party politics, and a high-profile advocate for Democratic candidates and values on television, she was a choice that would be acceptable to all sides. The DWS affair was just one high-wire act in a full-on backstage circus that Hillary's campaign tried mightily, and with mixed success, to hide from public view throughout the course of the convention. The truth was ugly. The die-hard Bernie backers, including a good number of delegates to the convention, still hated Hillary, and she was struggling to win over the factions they represented, progressive whites, millennials, and a small but committed set of people of color. She needed voters across the country to view her as the unchallenged choice of the delegates of the Democratic Party, and that would take a lot of doing. In her arsenal, she had shiny objects to distract from the mess. Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, and Katy Perry among them, as well as a ground force of allies culled from an unlikely source, the Sanders campaign. Behind the scenes, the Hillary and Bernie camps had been working together from early June through late July to try to ensure a smooth convention. It was a rocky process that included fights over the party's rules and its platform, but Hillary, who needed Bernie's voters, and Bernie, who didn't want to get blamed for electing Donald Trump, found common ground. The two campaign managers, Robbie Mook and Jeff Weaver, opened a running dialogue before the California primary in early June. Because Bernie's supporters were such dead-enders, and because the candidate himself wasn't really ready to give in until the last votes had been counted, it had taken a long time for Hillary and her team to figure out exactly what concessions Bernie was looking for and which ones could be accommodated. They outperformed, and they had huge expectations from their core political base that they couldn't walk away from, said one Democrat involved in the reconciliation process. Publicly, the Clinton camp tried to stay patient, sensitive to the backlash that could come from pushing Bernie too hard. But Hillary and her friends were also frustrated that Sanders wasn't able to snap his followers into line. In Brooklyn, Clinton aides joked about Bernie being the last Japanese World War II soldier tromping through the Philippines in the belief that the war was still being fought decades after it had ended. The period of détente had begun humbly, in a suite at the Capitol Hilton in Washington, down the street from the White House. Bernie arrived for the June 14th meeting with his hallmark yellow legal pad. "Congratulations, you've won the primary," he said as he sat down with Hillary in the living room. "I want to talk to you about some areas that I care about." Hillary said a few laudatory words about the campaign Sanders had run, and with that, they dived into the weeds of policy. Bernie believed that he couldn't just turn on a dime and endorse Hillary the way most politicians would. He felt that he owed it to his supporters to use the power of their votes to squeeze concessions from her. If he could make the case to them that she was incorporating their views into her agenda, they would be more likely to see his conversion as earnest and follow him into her fold. As he'd told Devine a week earlier, he saw this period before his formal endorsement as a moment of maximum leverage. Hillary listened carefully and followed her defeated rival into a thicket of complex issues. They talked about resolving doctor shortages at community health centers and college affordability. He wanted free tuition, while she favored a debt-free graduation plan. "These are the things I care a lot about, and I'd like to be able to jointly produce policy and talk about these to my supporters," he said. Hillary was polite and sympathetic, but noncommittal. She needed Bernie, but many more people had voted for her and her agenda. "It wasn't a love fest," said one person familiar with the discussion. "It was like two senators." Bernie had presented his wish list, and Hillary hadn't rejected it out of hand. But the real test of the ability of the two sides to make peace would come in the drafting of a party platform and the rules of the convention. Bernie was determined to affect the platform, and he believed that his showing in the primaries had earned him that right. Hillary had a different view. She won. But she also knew she needed to make enough accommodations to placate him. Moreover, even as Bernie and his top aides softened, his supporters didn't always follow suit. "They were trying to get their people in line," one Hillary source said. Her platform team, led by Sullivan, had put a lot of time and energy into her policy positions. It was the part of the campaign that mattered most to Hillary, and there was a deep reluctance to retreat from her goals. Hillary instructed her aides to maintain the principles that we successfully won the nomination on and not give ground, as one advisor put it. So they took the stance that they would compromise on the means of achieving policy ends, but not on the overall aims. Ultimately, though, the Clinton team negotiated on the minimum wage, fracking, and marijuana legalization, adopting more Bernie-esque approaches to each of those questions, and in the process, drafted what was widely described as the most progressive platform in modern Democratic Party history. But she would only bend so far. When Bernie's delegates tried to put a full moratorium on fracking, Hillary's beat them back. "We don't bluff," one of her aides said. "If we're telling you this is our bottom line, this is our fucking bottom line." Bernie's top advisors began to understand they could win concessions on the details, but many of his supporters were furious with each loss in the development of the platform. Meanwhile, Clinton's aides started to view the Sanders contingent as split between a set that would follow him in trying to bring the party together and a set that was more interested in disrupting the political order than it was loyal to Bernie. It was this second set that the leadership of both campaigns worried about on the eve of the convention. There was an overall strategic imperative to see if we could avoid a platform fight at the convention and a rules fight at the convention, said one Clinton campaign source who was involved in the discussions. The secondary and tertiary goals were to avoid a minority report full of pro-Bernie items and to prevent Sanders's forces from handing Republicans platform planks with which to whack Hillary in the general election. In the end, the platform threw enough vague concessions to Bernie that he could support it without locking Hillary into detailed promises on policy. "We pulled it off," this source said. "We didn't know that we would, but we did." Between the platform debate and the DWS denouement, the Clinton and Sanders camps had averted two major potential catastrophes before the convention even opened. But there was good reason for them to fear a full-scale revolt from Bernie's delegates. The platform talks had demonstrated goodwill on the part of Bernie and his top aides, but they'd also shown just how recalcitrant many of his supporters remained. Both sides knew that Bernie didn't really control them, and that meant they could sow chaos inside the hall and on television screens across the country. Heading into Monday, July 25th, the first day of the convention, Mook was nervous. "Absolutely shitting my pants," is how he described it to others. While her party's national convention was on the brink of disaster, Hillary was in Charlotte, North Carolina, addressing the Veterans of Foreign Wars convention. And things weren't going much better there. If there was ever an audience that needed persuasion to support Hillary, this was it. As she went through a version of her stump speech tailored for the veterans, Hillary looked out at a sea of blank stares. Of course, the VFW members applauded politely when she paid homage to the sacrifices of men and women in uniform, but she could tell they didn't care much for her or what she was saying. There was an invisible barrier between Hillary and her audience, and she thought it ran along the gender line. Having spent time with flag officers, soldiers, and veterans as a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee and as Secretary of State, she knew that some of them had a hard time accepting the idea of a female commander-in-chief. "That's the elephant in the room," she thought, and she decided to expose it. "I know this is the first time that one of our two major parties has ever nominated a woman," she said, deviating from her prepared remarks and earning a round of applause. "I know that it takes a little getting used to, even for me. But here's what I want you to know. I will get up every single day in the White House, doing everything I possibly can to protect our country, to treat our men and women in uniform with the care and concern and respect they deserve, to make good on our nation's promises to our veterans." That's the way I was raised. On the flight out afterward, Hillary offered a rare review of an audience to speechwriter Megan Rooney. They weren't feeling it, she said. Tough crowd. Rooney, wanting to know if the improvisation was a sign that Hillary would talk more about her gender on the campaign trail, prompted Hillary to explain the decision to go off script. I noticed that thing you added about women, the speechwriter said. I've been thinking about this, Hillary replied. People are interested in it, and this seemed like the right place to do it. Hillary knew she hadn't won over a lot of the veterans. No matter what she tried, it was hard to convince people who didn't want to envision her as president that they should vote for her anyway. This was as true for a group of mostly conservative veterans as it was for many other Americans, including a lot of less educated whites who had long ago made up their minds about her. For some, her education, privilege, and perceived sense of entitlement were more off-putting than her agenda, her secrecy, or even the way her voice hit their ears. She wasn't like them. And that made it harder, if not impossible, to get them to listen with an open mind. While her campaign aides had long recognized that many voters simply didn't like Hillary or what they thought she stood for, she had just been subjected to that painful truth herself. In Philadelphia, Hillary's team would have to put on such a dazzling show in front of the curtain for 4 days that no one could see the crises unfolding behind it. She faced two major conflicts as the convention opened, papering over her differences with Bernie and delivering an acceptance speech that would convince voters she had a better vision for America than Donald Trump. On the surface, the former would be a tougher challenge, but the absence of a motivation for her candidacy remained the biggest obstacle on Hillary's path to the presidency. Without that, her speech would be what she'd once derisively referred to as just words. Two things happened early Monday that illustrated the major tension points. First, Bernie's supporters booed Wasserman Schultz, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, and every mention of Hillary Clinton's name at events outside the perimeter of the Wells Fargo Center Convention Hall. As he watched the Bernie contingent wreak havoc, with formal protests outside the arena and sporadic bursts inside it, Mook's nervousness turned to agitation. Then, when Bernie delivered a speech to his delegates in a ballroom at the nearby Philadelphia Convention Center, they booed lustily when he spoke of his rival. Mook lost his temper. He picked up his phone and dialed Weaver. "What the fuck are you doing?" Mook demanded. But Weaver wasn't doing anything. The two campaign managers' worst fears were being realized. There was a segment of Bernie's constituency that was so angry they couldn't even stand silently by when he talked about his support for Hillary. And the television news cameras had a knack for giving every last dead-ender his or her moment of fame. The convention, they knew, could turn sideways fast. Fortunately for Hillary, for Bernie, and for the Democratic Party, Mook and Weaver had a contingency plan. About a week before the convention, they had put together a joint command operation behind the arena's main stage. The boiler room, a big open space filled with long tables, folding chairs, and telephones, functioned as a nerve center from which the two camps could exert control over their delegates during the four-day program. On one side sat an office for Clinton's senior staff, and on the other, a matching space for Bernie's top advisors. The phones, staffed by a mix of Hillary and Bernie aides, connected directly to phones on the convention floor designated for each state's delegation. The big unions, which had been divided in the primaries but would support the Democratic nominee, had their own whip operation humming nearby. The boiler room proved a physical nexus for the Bernie and Hillary brain trusts, but an electronic connection kept them in sync throughout the convention hall. The two teams created a text messaging distribution list that allowed for constant communication about potential problems during the four-day convention. When a Bernie supporter raised an anti-Clinton sign, a whip team member in the convention hall could relay the message quickly to the boiler room. The team there would send a note to Bernie and Hillary aides on the floor, who would ask the person to take it down. The flash speed communications network would turn out to be a major factor in transforming what was a tumultuous convention inside the hall into a unified one on television. That is, it looked a lot different to folks watching at home than it did to participants inside an arena with plenty of anti-Clinton Bernie delegates. The system got off to a rocky start. When Ohio Representative Marsha Fudge gaveled the convention to order on Monday afternoon, Bernie's delegates booed her. They chanted, "Bernie! Bernie! Bernie!" With his own speech scheduled for that night, Sanders sent a text message to his delegates imploring them to behave themselves on the floor. "I ask you as a personal courtesy to me not to engage in any kind of protest on the floor," he wrote. By this point, he had a lot of skin in the game. If he was seen as failing to unify a party that he had helped divide during the primary, his reputation would be permanently damaged. That didn't matter to his diehards. By the time Bernie left the stage that night to a roaring ovation, the storyline for the first day of the convention was simple: chaos. But Hillary would soon be the beneficiary of an Obama intervention. If the behavior of the Bernie contingent was one big tension point as the convention opened, the other was how Hillary would perform when she became the first woman to deliver a speech accepting the nomination of a major American political party. In addition to her own propensity for turning great prose into bland rhetoric, Hillary would be following an all-star cast of Democratic orators, including Barack and Michelle Obama, Bill Clinton, and Joe Biden. Indeed, the four-night extravaganza in Philadelphia would essentially be a parade of top Democrats coming to the stage at the Wells Fargo Center, on the outskirts of the nation's first capital, to lend their personal and political credibility to a candidate who badly needed praise from more trusted and liked figures. And Hillary would be delivering at a time when she had very little faith in her campaign's ability to produce speeches worthy of big moments. In victory and defeat, primary election nights had often been punctuated by the last-minute rending of her prepared remarks so that better text could be substituted. Hillary knew she had struggled to define herself and her campaign in ways that appealed to voters. She didn't like taking issues she'd been working on for years and boiling them down into little sound bites. She lived for the complexity. This wasn't a new problem. What was so frustrating is that it still hadn't been resolved. More than a year into the campaign, her staff didn't know her well enough to turn her candidacy into a compelling narrative for her. That wasn't exactly their fault. She'd been in the public eye for a quarter of a century, and voters didn't trust her. But in search of answers, ways to convince voters that she was not only better than Trump, but worthy of their trust, respect, and even sympathy, she had turned, once again, to outside help. Hillary had secretly tapped Lissa Muscatine months earlier to develop a memo that would serve as the blueprint for the convention speech and her general election messaging. First and foremost, the goal of the speech was to illustrate Hillary's deep contrasts with Donald Trump. Given her own poor approval ratings, her top priority was to disqualify Trump in the minds of voters. She and her team presumed that if Americans believed Trump was unqualified for the presidency, she would win by default. Her team thought of the core of her argument as three hinges: unity versus division, an economy for everyone versus Trump being in it for himself, and her steadiness versus the risk of Trump. The campaign's slogan, "Stronger Together," was a consensus point among a series of independent working groups inside and outside the campaign. It was poll-tested and grounded in Trump's negatives, the opposite of the division he sowed, rather than being a true shorthand for Hillary's approach to improving the country. She didn't love it when it was first presented to her at a meeting in a hotel in Westchester in the late spring. It was the best of the slogans she'd seen, she said. After letting it sit for a couple of days, she gave the go-ahead. Hillary understood the imperative of disqualifying Trump, but she also wanted to turn the public's perception of her in a more positive direction, and that meant focusing more on how her personality and values drove her to public service. That was a tall order for a woman who was so preternaturally private and inaccessible to the public. To help with the task, Muscatine assembled a small team: Jeff Schessel, Vinca LaFleur, Jen Klein, and Judith McHale, that mixed veteran speechwriters and people who knew Hillary well on a personal level. As usual, Dan Schwerin had the unenviable task of running the formal speechwriting process. In June and July, he cast a wide net for input on what Hillary should say. He spoke to Bill Clinton and former White House speechwriter Don Baer and branding specialist Roy Spence, as well as Jim Kennedy, a News Corp executive and Clinton World veteran who had crafted the famous 18 million cracks line in Hillary's 2008 concession speech. Schwerin huddled with Kennedy several weeks before the convention at the Coliseum, an Irish bar near Columbus Circle on New York's Upper West Side. There, for the better part of 2 hours, over appetizers and beer, Kennedy gave Schwerin advice. Schwerin was eager to hear Kennedy's ideas on elements of both process and substance, and he knew that Hillary loved Kennedy's way of refining complicated concepts into a handful of words. In hallmark fashion, Hillary had set up two separate and isolated teams to write her convention speech. Muscatine's prose worked under the cover of darkness. Schwerin represented the official campaign apparatus, which had failed over the course of a year to supply Hillary with the words that could connect her personal story to the aspirations and needs of voters. This wasn't lost on Schwerin, who had complained repeatedly about the challenge of getting Hillary to find her own vision. For this speech, Kennedy, Philippe Raines, Jon Favreau, and the consultants, Benenson, Grunwald, and Margolis, chipped in their thoughts. Schwerin also consulted with economic policy experts Neera Tanden and Gene Sperling, as well as former State Department officials Nick Burns, Kurt Campbell, and Anne-Marie Slaughter. In part because so many of his colleagues were occupied with other tasks at the convention, Schwerin thought the process was going much more smoothly than it had on major speeches earlier in the campaign. It was, but that didn't mean the product was strong. When he unveiled his first full draft on the opening day of the convention, even some of his closest friends thought it was in embarrassingly rough shape. If you want to share a draft because you want input, sometimes you share it when it's not formed yet, said one of Schwerin's colleagues who sympathized with the difficulty of the process. Dan wants to bring people into the process and be solicitous. He has a very low ego when it comes to edits and ideas. There's a cost to that. The outside speechwriters criticized it as a cut-and-paste job of previous work that sounded as dry as a State of the Union address. They thought it lacked both personal detail and that elusive commander-in-chief vibe. Where she'd been too ironclad in her 2008 run, there was a danger that she would be too soft now. This first draft had a lot of talk about love and kindness, but if Hillary wanted to be believable as president, she couldn't promise to take on ISIS, Vladimir Putin, Iranian mullahs, and North Korea by talking like a PTA leader. They went straight to Hillary to make sure the candidate knew the pros would have to quickly apply thick layers of foundation to obscure a blemished draft. "They were really critical, and it was tough," said one campaign aide. "I think they wanted to be constructive. I don't think that was the end result." As the first night of the convention drew toward its close, Hillary's speech was a disaster. Bernie's delegates were waging war against her, and the underlying level of unrest was even more pervasive than the flashes of protest visible on television. And then, in a few minutes at the end of the night, Michelle Obama turned the narrative on its head. The First Lady had flown into Philadelphia that night in the middle of a violent thunderstorm. The plane she was traveling on, a Boeing C-32 often used by Vice President Joe Biden, was rocked by turbulence and had to circle several times before it landed. Others on the flight felt sick to their stomachs, but Michelle Obama strode off the plane as if nothing had happened, knowing all too well what she was there to do that night. More than anything that evening, Michelle Obama's powerful address would offer an echo of one particular speech from 2008, Hillary Clinton's concession. It was no coincidence, either. The speechwriter who had so powerfully crafted Obama's speech, Sarah Hurwitz, had been the lead writer for the concession address Clinton delivered in Washington's National Building Museum 8 years earlier. In Michelle's speech, Hurwitz described Clinton as someone who has the guts and the grace to keep coming back and putting those cracks in that highest and hardest glass ceiling until she finally breaks through. "And because of Hillary Clinton, my daughters and all our sons and daughters now take for granted that a woman can be president of the United States." That line recalled one Hurwitz wrote for Hillary in 2008. "Because of the abolitionists and suffragists, children today will grow up taking for granted that an African American or a woman can, yes, become the president of the United States." Hillary's primary victory, and her top aides believed her path to the presidency, relied heavily on an Obama-like coalition driven by African Americans and women of all races and ethnicities. Hurwitz's words, "a circle connecting the Obama and Clinton coalitions," illustrated the perfect distinction between enlightened homage and pure plagiarism, the route Melania Trump had taken the week before in repeating Michelle Obama's words from the 2008 Democratic Convention as a testament to her own husband. The Melania debacle had so worried Michelle's aides that they Googled clips and phrases of her speech repeatedly to make certain that nothing she said had been uttered before. Even something as anodyne as, "There but for the grace of God go I," was flagged by the staff. Hurwitz assured them that such an aphorism was perfectly fine. Unlike Hillary's chaotic speechwriting process, Michelle Obama's had been elegant and efficient. Her address was signed and sealed a couple of weeks before it was delivered. And the delivery was a showstopper. The First Lady gave a positively glowing endorsement of Hillary and slapped Trump without ever mentioning his name, speaking about the difficulties of raising two young girls in the White House amid a 24-hour news cycle that spewed vicious criticism of their father, and how they taught their girls to cope. "How we urge them to ignore those who question their father's citizenship or faith. How we insist that the hateful language they hear from public figures on TV does not represent the true spirit of this country. How we explain that when someone is cruel or acts like a bully, you don't stoop to their level, she said. No, our motto is, when they go low, we go high. Michelle Obama's concise and powerful endorsement of Hillary reset the narrative of the convention from one of chaos to one of lockstep unity at the top echelon of the party. The two women, with their vastly different styles, were not close personally, which made the moment of validation that much more persuasive. On the question of whether Hillary was a better choice for president than Donald Trump, there wasn't a millimeter of daylight between them. The testimonials would flow forth over the course of the week, but Hillary's case for herself was not coming together. Schussel and LaFleur, who ran Washington's most prominent political and corporate speechwriting shop, were the invisible hands that drafted and delivered the backbone and much of the meat of the full speech by the time the convention got underway. But the first full version had Schwerin's fingerprints all over it. He was fighting them with the power he had, control over the keyboard. There were two different drafts going back and forth, one Hillary aide said of the confusion. So, several times a day, new drafts with significant changes would appear in the inboxes of the dozen or so people tied to the process. Most of them had little or no idea whose hands, other than Schwerin's, were on the speech. Favreau, the former chief Obama speechwriter, thought the first version he'd seen before the start of the convention was long and meandering at best. But as Schwerin incorporated the thoughts of the committee, it seemed to be getting worse, and quickly. Panicked, Favreau shipped Schwerin his own revisions, mostly just line edits. In his view, the speech was classically Clintonian in its 1990s feel. Even though Hillary didn't like sound bites, she and her husband were always looking to insert something that would lead the news in the next day's paper. That, Favreau thought, is what made Hillary sound fake. And when she and her team hit on something great, they'd kill it with over-repetition. In one early version, though, Favreau saw the seeds of a powerful argument against Trump's temperament. He sanded down the words, first written by Schussel, to, "A man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons." It would end up being the most memorable line of Hillary's speech. Still, Favreau's involvement and the belief that he promoted his work to reporters would leave lingering bitterness on the palates of some of Hillary's top supporters. Inside the boiler room and around the convention hall, Clinton and Sanders' aides worked to quiet the recalcitrants. On the first day, their text messaging coordination system hadn't prevented pro-Bernie delegates from making a scene. But by Tuesday, after Bernie had called for Hillary's election from the podium the night before, the two camps found more success in tamping down dissent. The haters were harder to find by the time Bill Clinton took the stage Tuesday night with the express mission of acting as a character witness for his wife. It was the right role for the spouse of a presidential nominee, though an unusual one for a former president and for someone whose own character flaws were part of the Republican case against Hillary. But since her mother had died a few years earlier, no one on the planet could claim to know Hillary better than Bill. He had begun thinking about how he wanted to describe his wife to the country a month or more before the convention. The ask from Hillary was to give the country a window into her core, the very thing she had so much difficulty doing. America knew her, or thought it did, but Bill could give voters more information. He would sketch a biographical narrative of his wife, and he asked a series of people close to her to offer their thoughts on what should be included. The actual writing started about 2.5 weeks out, as Bill huddled with his personal speechwriter, Steve Reinhardt. Bill would occasionally ask other aides for a few facts and figures that could be sprinkled into his draft, but it was very closely held until just before the convention opened. On Sunday night, about 48 hours before he was to take the stage, Bill distributed the first 4 or 5 pages of the speech to a wider group of aides and advisors, but he kept the rest to himself. During the commotion of Monday's chaotic opening of the convention, Bill sequestered himself in the presidential suite at the Logan, Philadelphia, overlooking a stately fountain with a downtown view. The former president is a gifted writer, according to people who have seen his raw copy, if prone to cliché and a little in love with his own words. Crooking his left hand, he scrawled out his thoughts on a yellow legal pad. Bill would deliver pages to Reinhardt, who offered his own opinions on structure and phrasing, and then dutifully typed the draft into his computer. They worked all day Monday, and Bill shared the full speech with his core group of personal aides on Tuesday during the day. It was running long, no surprise to anyone who had spent any time around the former president, and he worked with his team to try to trim it back under 40 minutes. They made a few tweaks, but it was mostly what Bill had put to paper. How could anyone else really tell the story of Hillary Clinton better, or more accurately, than he could? No one dared to tell him that he'd glossed over her loyalty in the face of his publicly revealed sexual dalliances, a fact that would be obvious to anyone who listened to the speech when he delivered it. It wasn't their place to get inside his marriage, even if it meant letting him expose himself and his wife to a lot of chatter about the Monica Lewinsky affair. Bill took the podium to a raucous standing ovation on Tuesday night, a grayer, more frail returning champion. If there was one thing Bill's fans and sworn enemies could agree on, it was his ability to compel an audience. He opened up with an anecdote, the kind that only he could tell and that no opposition researcher could hope to unravel. In the spring of 1971, I met a girl. The first time I saw her, we were, appropriately enough, in a class on political and civil rights. She had thick blonde hair, big glasses, wore no makeup, and she exuded this sense and strength of self-possession that I found magnetic, he began. After the class, I followed her out, intending to introduce myself. I got close enough to touch her back, but I couldn't do it. Somehow I knew this would not be just another tap on the shoulder, that I might be starting something I couldn't stop. Everyone's mind went to the same place, a confidant of Hillary's later confessed. No one else could ever know whether it was Hillary's back that Bill had chosen not to touch. But in Bill's telling, it was a sweet story of innocent fascination. He spent the next 45 minutes talking about the Hillary he knew, the one he'd walked and talked and laughed with for nearly half a century, the one who threw herself into social justice and child welfare issues, switched parties over the Vietnam War, registered Mexican-American voters in Texas, repeatedly refused his entreaties to marry him before finally acceding, took Chelsea to t-ball, volleyball, and ballet, took up controversial policy initiatives on his behalf in Arkansas and Washington, including the Federal Children's Health Insurance Program, and served the nation as First Lady, Senator, and then Secretary of State. Now, how does this square? How did this square with the things that you heard at the Republican convention? What's the difference in what I told you and what they said? How do you square it? Bill asked the convention hall. You can't. One is real, the other is made up. And you just have to decide. And you just have to decide which is which, my fellow Americans. The real one had done more positive change-making before she was 30 than most politicians do with a lifetime in office. It came off as sincere. Coming off as sincere is one of Bill's specialties, even when he's lying, and served its purpose. But it was hardly Bill's most passionate or effective address. He wanted Hillary to be president, and he was playing his role. The big dog still had a little magic left in him, but not enough to be the star of the convention. Hillary arrived in Philadelphia on Wednesday, July 27th, in time to hear Barack Obama, her former boss and the most popular politician in America, praise her to the heavens. She was there, but her speech wasn't, nor were two of its authors. Schessel and LaFleur, who along with Muscatine and Klein had written a significant portion of the address, weren't originally given credentials for the convention by the campaign. Muscatine and Klein had to scare up a couple of passes so the pair could be there to hear the words they had written. The snub reflected the tension between the campaign and these outsiders. In the final week or so, drafts had been flying back and forth, with Muscatine and her group delivering big chunks from Washington, and Schwerin assembling their work and that of others. Schwerin was still trying to stitch it all together when Hillary landed in Philadelphia the day before her big moment. He gave her a copy of the latest draft that day, and she would spend much of the next 24 hours going over it with him, Megan Rooney, Jake Sullivan, and her husband. Her granddaughter played in the suite as she went through her remarks line by line. Meanwhile, Barack Obama was excited about hitting the convention stage one more time. For his re-election in 2012, he had leaned a little on Bill as his explainer-in-chief, and he was eager to repay the favor by boosting Hillary. Inside the White House, the speech was treated with the reverence of a State of the Union, only the draft of this testimonial was kept mostly between Obama himself and his chief speechwriter. Cody Keenan had written some of the president's most poetic speeches, including the one he delivered in the wake of the Sandy Hook school shooting. Obama's aides solicited input on the themes of the speech from Hillary's camp, but they never shared the text. Hillary didn't ask for it, a sign of the deep trust that she and Obama had developed since he'd first asked her to serve as Secretary of State. The main aspect of Hillary that Obama could speak to, that not even Bill could, was the way she responded to a crisis in the White House Situation Room. As First Lady, she had been kept in the loop about many of Bill's policies and decisions, but she had served at Obama's elbow and helped guide him through war, diplomacy, and the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. She had recommended he launch that strike against the advice of Vice President Joe Biden and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, at a time when everyone understood a failure could spell doom for Obama's re-election hopes the following year. By adding her signature to bin Laden's death warrant, she assured Obama that his main intra-party rival would be by his side on the most audacious act of his presidency. Hillary was uniquely prepared to make those decisions, he told the nation. But even Obama struggled to get past Hillary's shell and find the core humanity that voters would seek. He knew her well, and yet his endorsement rested on her capacity to handle the job. You know, nothing truly prepares you for the demands of the Oval Office. Until you've sat at that desk, you don't know what it's like to manage a global crisis or send young people to war, he said with hallmark authenticity. But Hillary's been in the room. She's been part of those decisions. She knows what's at stake in the decisions our government makes for the working family, the senior citizen, the small business owner, the soldier, and the veteran. Even in the middle of crisis, she listens to people and keeps her cool and treats everybody with respect. And no matter how daunting the odds, no matter how much people try to knock her down, she never, ever quits. It was the following line that caught Bill Clinton's attention. "That's the Hillary I know. That's the Hillary I've come to admire," Obama testified. "And that's why I can say with confidence there has never been a man or a woman more qualified than Hillary Clinton to serve as President of the United States of America." Obama wasn't much for humility, and neither was Bill. The current president had just said that neither of them came to the Oval Office with Hillary's know-how. After Obama laid out the case against Donald Trump, Bill met him backstage to offer his thanks. "I enjoyed what you said," the former president drawled, making a reference to the line. It had been 8 years since Bill had tried to cajole superdelegates by insisting that Obama wasn't prepared for the office, that he wouldn't be able to handle it. Now, Obama had revealed that he believed Hillary was better qualified than Bill had been. "It happens to be true," Obama said, keeping any hint of ironic smugness to himself. He saw Hillary backstage, too, and she looked worn around the edges. The look was familiar to the president. Early in his first term, he'd noticed that his Secretary of State had only one gear, and he worried that she would burn herself out, that she couldn't keep up her pace and remain in good health. The month before the convention, Obama advised her that she was in a sprint to the finish line. But now, as he took stock of his former Secretary of State and would-be successor, he sensed that she still wasn't taking good enough care of herself. Obama had shown, in the face of criticism, that he understood the importance of downtime, a round on the golf course, even a smoke break. But that just wasn't in Hillary's DNA. "It's quite a stretch from now to November," Obama said. "You've got to make sure you rest. Take a vacation." "I know," Hillary said. "I know, I know. I've got to do that." But she didn't really know how to slow down. Left to her own devices, she would run herself into the ground. Hillary's own speech still wasn't set by late Wednesday night, less than 24 hours before her crowning moment as the first female presidential nominee of a major party. Having watched the Obamas wow the convention crowd, Hillary told Schwerin they needed to turn things up a notch. "Okay," she said. "We've got to make this really good." As Schwerin was well aware, his candidate was following not only both Obamas but also Bill Clinton. And the nominee's speech isn't usually the most memorable of a convention. At the GOP's confab the week before, it was Ted Cruz's admonishment to vote your conscience that had captured the attention of the political world. Ted Kennedy had stolen the show at the 1980 Democratic Convention, and Barack Obama had first risen to prominence in 2004 when John Kerry was accepting the Democratic nomination. Other speakers could give tight, focused speeches, but the nominee was always trying to do a lot of things at once. It would be a tough feat, he thought, to make Hillary stand out. Some of the others had been brilliant. Schwerin was hoping Hillary would be good. He went to work with Sullivan and Rooney into the wee hours of Thursday morning, trying to sharpen Hillary's lines. Overall, the structure of the speech was set, but there was too much flab. Later Thursday morning, they felt they had whittled it down enough to show Hillary again. After she and Bill had taken a look, Schwerin emailed the near-final draft to his colleagues. Muscatine, Schessel, and LaFleur were shocked at what they saw. They had worked on a few different endings for the speech, but the draft they were looking at was completely different from all of them. It wasn't clear whether Schwerin had messed with it, or whether it was Bill or Hillary, but it didn't sound like Schwerin. They didn't think it was right, but it was highly professional. He could never have done that, said one person who saw that version of the speech. All the pros could see from the text was that many of their favorite words were absent from the final run of the speech. In their place stood a handful of paragraphs that the three wordsmiths found jarring, not only in the context of the rest of the narrative, but really on all levels. They sent slack-jawed emails to one another and even hopped on the phone. Muscatine said she would take a shot at a replacement. Schessel and Lafleur were just arriving by train to New York's Penn Station when Muscatine sent them 7 or 8 lines as the dough for a new ending. There, two of the most successful speechwriters in the business refined Muscatine's ideas in 30 minutes and fired the new section off to the campaign. Schwerin put 3 different endings on the table, his own, one from Muscatine, Schessel, and Lafleur, and one from Kennedy, and melded them. The pros took a look at the compromise and thought a pretty powerful speech would now end the way Hillary's launch speech had landed, with a whimper. The day of the address, she set up 2 sessions with Michael Sheehan, a veteran speech coach, in a conference room. Bill sat quietly in the back as Hillary took her place behind a podium and looked up at the teleprompter. After the first run-through, Hillary seemed pleased. "That's pretty good," she assessed. "I like it." Hillary was comfortable with the text, but Sheehan gave her a handful of pointers on pacing and tone. He showed her the best way to emphasize certain words, especially those that might be punchier than they seemed on paper. He instructed her on how close to stand to the podium so she could put her hands on it and use it, but also give herself a free range of movement for gestures. One person in the room noticed a change in how easily Hillary could be coached around Sheehan. He had a way of connecting with her that many others did not. She could often be dismissive of suggestions when she was sensitive to the criticism, as she had been in debate prep the day after the Michigan primary. But now she had the confidence to take in what Sheehan was saying. Rather than her standard, "Yeah, I got it," response to instruction, she was asking Sheehan to give her more. And her delivery was a full dress rehearsal. "She really brought it," the aide said. When Hillary became impassioned behind a microphone, she often